Don Rolke is an ordained minister with the United Church of Canada and a registered massage therapist in Regina's Cathedral area. For the past 4 years, Don has worked in a ministry of friendship and reconciliation with First Nations people. She is also a spirituality teacher at the Regina Jail, where she is accompanied by her dog, Jack. Dawn recently began piano lessons and is determined to stick with it this time. As the bemused owner of two canines, she thinks that dogs are the answer to just about all of life's questions. Welcome, Dawn.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. We gather on Treaty 4 land today. I've put together some images for you, and I'm going to move through them fairly quickly. At least that's my intention. And there will be, I'm sure, things about the presentation or images that grab you. And that will be the most interesting part of our time together. So in moving through the slides fairly quickly, then we can spend more time on your questions and interests afterwards. I have brought a board that will be probably more clear if we look at it downstairs during the potluck afterwards and interact with it. I can explain it to you then. I may refer to it during the presentation. So I'm here today to speak certainly on behalf of myself as a citizen of Regina on Saskatchewan and Canada, and as a member of the United Church of Canada, and most recently as a member of the Cemetery Commemoration Working Group. I keep changing the title of the presentation, and I think probably when I gave it to Helen, I said living the apology, and then last night it became towards reconciliation. So that gives you a sense of how this topic is evolving in my mind almost daily. I want to begin by asking how many of you folks are aware of the industrial school that used to exist 4 miles northwest of Regina, the Regina Indian Industrial School. Okay. And also, how many of you are aware or have visited the little cemetery that was once connected with that industrial school? So, okay, thanks. Could I just have the first image? I wanted to just locate this, to put in a picture in our minds of the industrial school. Completed in 1891. And the next slide. This location is where the Paul Dojak Center now sits, and I'll show you a slide in a moment of the Paul Dojak Center so you can get a sense of things. The avenue, Ritter Avenue, is the street that you see actually coming in from sort of that back angle to a corner of the school. I'll have the next slide. That's a graduating class, obviously, from 1898. Originally, the school was designed for students who would come from other boarding schools in the beginning, 1891, for a few years. The students were older, 15, 16, 17, and then as the years passed, the students got younger and younger until after 1900, until the school closed in 1910, the records show that children as young as 3, 4, and 5 were being enrolled in the school. Please. So that is actually the Ritter Avenue Road that goes into the school. The chronology of the school is very sketchy from the slides that you've just seen, sort of 1898 to 1905. Then we jump in what we know about the school to 1921. The school was closed in 1910 for the reasons that industrial schools across Canada closed after usually a 15 or 20 year run. They were very expensive to maintain. The idea of having lots of land, lots of industrial options for the students to learn, so welding, printing, farming, gardening, cooking, etc., just was so expensive, and the government didn't hand the schools the money until the student was at the school. So it was kind of that circular thing of can't expand the school till you have the money, don't have the money until you get the students. And a really important part of this era of residential schools is that it wasn't yet law to send your student. And so First Nations parents and chiefs still had some agency on whether or not to send their students. And for me, that's one of the most important reasons why the story of this school needs to be told. There's so many reasons. But one of the reasons is parents and chiefs still had some agency. And principals were really going out to reserves, usually guided by a First Nations guide, especially in the late 1800s. And they were courting them. They were really presenting a strong case for why they should send their schools, and as often as their students, and as often as not, the chiefs and the family members were saying, no, I don't think so, too far away. So we need to know that there is a different narrative. The narrative that we've been hearing so much during the Truth and Reconciliation is of students just being taken and parents just, you know, giving the students away, giving their children away more or less. But this is an earlier narrative, and it's a really important one. So in 1921, back to that slide for a moment. In 1921, the school's been closed for 11 years. John, could I have that earlier slide? Yeah. And talk of the school seems to have really quieted down in Regina. And that partly that was that when the schools appear to have failed, the churches got really quiet about them. Embarrassment, who knows what it was. But the Presbyterian Church ran this school. And in 1921, we have this letter that was sent to Indian Agent Graham, a well-known Indian agent in southern Saskatchewan. And it is a passionate plea by a Presbyterian woman saying that the cemetery has gone wild. She doesn't use those words. She says that no one is tending to the cemetery, that all the crosses that marked the students who were buried there and the fence that marked off the cemetery has been burned in a prairie fire, that cattle are now using it as pasture. Deep ruts are in the land. And she begs Agent Graham to call upon the government to mark off and protect this sacred site. So this letter, as far as anybody knows, disappeared and was certainly never dealt with. Next slide. The next time we hear about the school is 1948, when the school burned to the ground. And by that point, the building after the school closed in 1910, and of course we don't know where the students went at that time, the Regina Jail was moved to the location, so that became the Regina Jail. And after it ceased as the Regina Jail, it became a home for delinquent boys under 16. Delinquent and orphaned boys. And in 1948, one of those boys attempting to create a distraction from the sound of it started a little fire, which became a big fire, and the school burned right to the earth. Next slide. All the students were moved out, and that really ended the era of the industrial school. And this is the site now. So it became, it continued as a home for delinquent boys, shall we say, and as the Paul Dojak Youth Center. So the Ritter Avenue, as you can see, is that old road that came into the industrial school. And I want to point out two things. As we've begun giving these presentations, we've learned that there are probably some early burials up there that are currently unmarked. As we show this presentation around the city, First Nations people come to it. There's lots of stories and anecdotes, especially by people who've worked at the Paul Dojak Center. And someone who worked at the Paul Dojak Center told us last week that he's fairly certain there's graves up here, which would really make sense. Because the schools tended to, the school existed, and it seems as if it didn't occur to anyone that there would be deaths. But when there were deaths, they buried the children at the far edge of the properties. And this is very consistent across Canada. So against that fence, which would have marked the perimeter of the industrial school. And the cemetery that I'm going to talk about now is over here. So again, the cemetery that we do know of and that we have, that has been recently remembered or found, is against what was the other far perimeter of the industrial school. So it's very interesting to talk to Paul Dojak workers because they've been talking about this for a long time. Yeah, next slide. So this is what remains of the little cemetery site. It's got an address, 701 Pinky Road. In 2009, this piece of land was purchased by the RM, the City of Regina, from the RM of Sherwood. Yeah. And so it became part of city property. And that's when we started to see this cemetery mentioned again in city documents. So it became part of the city property, and then fairly quickly after that, it was purchased by two investors from Brampton, sight unseen. So this is frontage land on Pinky Road. And looking at the thing this way, if you come out Dewdney, past Courtney Street, and turn right, you'll drive right past this. I'm one of many people who for years has just every now and then drive up and down Pinky Road because there's a rumor of a cemetery there, but I just wasn't able to. It never caught my eye, and you can kind of see why. So next slide, please. These are hard, but again, this just puts it in context for you. So the former site, and of course that's now the Dojak Center, you can see the red roofs, and then way over there is the cemetery site. That's on Pinky Road. So the land, one of the reasons this feels important right now is that certainly the little piece of land has been bought, and it's been bought by investors, and it is on the way to what we're calling the hub. So it's important land, especially because the cemetery sits right on the frontage of that land. And it's a strange little parcel that they bought. You can see how it's wider in the back and long and narrow in the front where the cemetery is. So, next picture, please. And that's just more of a close-up, but it's... Yeah. Now, the little buildings you see up at the top there kind of look like water, but they're buildings. And that's Avram Construction. And those people have been there for decades. And in fact, they know more about the cemetery than anyone. Go figure. So next slide. There's just a chronological look for you. Thanks. So this is one of the neighbors. And In 2010 or something, an amateur historian in Regina, was doing some research on a prominent Regina character and came across a reference to the residential school. And that set him on this little journey of discovery. And he knew the people at Avram Construction. And when he went there, this guy said, yeah, I used to mow that. And he said, there is a tombstone there, but it's completely buried by now. So it was this guy who went and showed Don Black where this little cemetery was. And next slide, please. And that's what it is up close. Even though the letter from 1921 says definitively that there are 35 to 40 children buried here, no one would really take this cemetery seriously until this tombstone was dug up. And this shows that the first principal a Reverend MacDonald buried two of his infant children here when they died very young, and this is the tombstone for them. So this was the only stone tombstone. The markers for the First Nations children were simple wooden crosses, and that's why their sites are unmarked at this time. So, thanks. Next one. Don Black felt quite concerned that something be done around this cemetery, and he began to speak to First Nations chiefs whose interest was peripheral. They basically said, it sounds important, so like let us know how it proceeds. Call us when something develops. And he had a difficult time finding anyone who was interested. He worked through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. A person came out, and together they spoke to Lisa Hine. And she's a geologist with Stantec. And on she said that she would work on the cemetery for free. Yeah, if you can give me the next slide. So they used a non-invasive technique to just take an electromagnetic device, and scan over the cemetery plot. And again, with the blessing of a First Nations person from the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, this work was done. Because the land has blown so much, it's been open prairie for so long, and the grasses now prevent dirt from moving, but before the grasses grew up on it, you know, there's like this much land that's blown from one end of the cemetery to the other. So what they were able to discern is that at this end of the property, very close to where the little stone tombstone was found, they can detect that there are these shafts below the ground. It's not a pure science. So all that the magnetic device can tell is where the land has been disturbed, where there has been a shaft created, which is the starting point for detecting whether there's a shaft there. But there's so much land that has built up on this side of the cemetery that there is simply no way to tell. It's too much land between the device and where the burial site would be. So it's a start, but to know any more, there would have to be, First Nations people would have to decide that it's worth it to actually scrape back some of that land that's been blown on to determine if there are more grave sites there. I think the only concern, there's many concerns, but one of the concerns is that the current parameters of the cemetery aren't the real parameters, and that there's actually grave shafts outside. And so if you trust the current markers of the cemetery right now, it's very possible that, some graves will be missed. Some graves are outside of that marker. Okay. Thanks. One of the things Don Black did in the last year and a half, and you've probably seen it in the media, was he really attempted to get the word out. He just wanted people in Regina to know about this cemetery. He was at that time chair of the Municipal Heritage Committee, and he did work through his position, but the Heritage Committee deals mostly with buildings, and the city was really iffy about whether or not they wanted to be involved because the land had just been sold. So nobody was really wanting to take responsibility for this. So Don Black felt that the best thing to do was get a lot of people talking about it. So put the word out there so that many people would come forward to the city and say, hey, this land needs to be protected. So he did a media blitz, and everybody picked it up. There was a lot of good articles and 5-minute blurbs on radio and TV as well. I became involved through my work that Andrew mentioned earlier. I was working in a ministry of friendship and reconciliation. And at the national level, the United Church has a person whose entire portfolio is to deal with residential schools, missing children, and unmarked graves. So that's part of the work that the United Church has identified for itself at this time, especially because the United Church inherited 7 schools from the Presbyterians and 5 schools from the Methodist when the United Church formed in 1925, and really just took on and carried on with those schools as had been done before. So this started off as a Presbyterian school, and it was a Presbyterian school when it closed in 1910, but we've inherited the history in a way. So next slide, please. This is how I hope you can understand that. So it was Knox Presbyterian that found ministers for the school, developed the school. It was, that's who the government asked to run this school and develop the school. And then when Knox Presbyterian ceased to exist, in 1925, the United Church formed. And so Knox Presbyterian was no more. It became Knox. Knox Presbyterian was no more. It became Knox Met. And the Presbyterians who didn't want to join the United Church created themselves a new worshiping community. I hope that makes sense. So some of the history went down to Knox Met, but they had no ownership or no sense of it. And then some of the documents went to the First Presbyterian. So it's hard to tease that out. When my colleague at the national office asked me over and over to please investigate this cemetery, finally last fall I had some time and I decided to dig into that. And of course the first thing I had to do was a bit of education for myself. So I went to Sask Archives, and they have a smattering of things, but the most important documents that I saw were the admissions record, the original admissions record for the school, beginning in 1891, and I think it ends, they stopped recording students in 1909. So this is a microfiche copy. And again, that's just a close-up. So they put the name in the early years. There was the First Nations name, the date the student came, the age. So you can see here we have a five-year-old, and there were various other things that they wrote down. This is also on microfiche, and it's an extremely troubling portrayal of what we said and how we thought in the 1890s. As I say, the industrial school had a printing press, and so it was very important for them. It was probably their most prominent method of propaganda, and it went out to 500 families across Canada and in Regina. People paid for the paper, and they kept the whole country and city updated on local and foreign Indian missions, as they were called. Okay. So I just began making phone calls to find out who else might be interested in working on this cemetery, and started talking about it to everybody I met. But I also went to the Knox Met Outreach Committee, the First Presbyterian Outreach Committee. I started talking to descendants of former students. And people were interested. Everybody I talked to was interested. There was such an immediate grab for this topic at this time, and it was just one of those things. So very, very quickly, we came together into a working group of sorts to decide where to next. This is one of the things we've done with... having copied all the microfiche, I then transcribed the names of all the students on computer and then put them into reserves or geographical areas. And these are the geographical areas that the students came from to attend the industrial school. And the different colors of dots show how many students. So, for example, there's a little area up by Prince Albert, and they had 48 students. Cody Reserve by CAMSAC had 52 students. The area sort of south of Regina collectively had 110 students. So once we could see where the students came from, then we knew who we needed to talk to. And then with the assistance of our guiding elders, we began to ask for appointments with chiefs or councils or the experts on burials from each band, and sit down with them, tell them who we were and what we wanted. So that's how what we're doing now. So we're continuing to learn everything we can, talking to as many people as we can, and communicating broadly. There's As I did this PowerPoint, I realized how linear it was, and the little arrows weren't working on my PowerPoint. But what I really wanted, the way our committee is really working is, you know, I'm here, and I just talked to 10 people, and then Bob, one of our members, is here, and he's talking to 10 people, and those 10 people are talking to another 10 people, so it's not linear at all. And our interest is that if anyone knows someone who might be interested, please tell them. And we want to be as transparent as possible to indicate that we're not holding on to this material. We know that anytime we do these kinds of things, it can really be politically fraught. And I'm getting lots of phone calls where people are saying, who do you think you are, and you know, why wasn't I called, and you need to stop this right now because you're not following the proper protocol. And I'm so glad I have 4 years experience of getting those comments, because 4 years ago that would have stopped me dead in my tracks. And I feel encouraged, I think, and strengthened by Justice Murray Sinclair, who has been speaking very sternly to the churches as the head of the TRC process. And he has said, this is not the time to run away with your tail between your legs. Take courage. Like, stay in the game. So for every person that tells us that we need to stop talking about this and we're doing it wrong, there are other people who say there's no one right way to do things, and just carry on. So anybody, as far as we're concerned, anybody that wants to be part of this can be part of it. And the other thing is, anybody can go to SASC archives and get the information that we've gotten. It's not private material. And we're working to not, we're also not privilege the material, the written material, because it's so easy to do that as white people. You know, I really latch on to these documents. But we're trying to remember that all of the anecdotal stories that we're hearing, the oral stories, the stuff that's come down, that's equally privileged. Like, that is also totally true. We're not trying to determine exactly who went to the schools, just what do we need now to do now to make it right. That's really the leading principle. Is there anything we need to do right now to make it right, and what might that thing be? So thank you. So for me and for others of us, I'm very drawn to the cemetery work and to the children who went there and who were buried in the cemetery in order to live out the apologies that I have claimed, the apologies that the United Church has made for our role in residential schools and the process of colonization and nation building, and then the Canadian apology as well. And to ensure that the cemetery is properly set aside, if that is in fact what the First Nations people want. To ensure that the deceased are honored in culturally appropriate ways, if the First Nations people decide that's what they want. So all we're really doing is gathering some information together and contacting very, very busy chiefs. In case there is something that needs to happen. What we do know is that in other places in Canada, people are doing the same thing. There are forgotten burial grounds or disremembered burial grounds in lots of places. And it seems important to at least lift them up and say, there's this burial site here, unmarked, neglected, uncared for, forgotten. Is there anything we need to do to honor these children? A lot of my friends, especially my older First Nations friends, believe that the children are not resting in peace. That's a very strong belief for them and a very deep concern, that the children have not had the appropriate cultural ceremonies to allow them to rest in peace. So the sense is that their spirits are wandering out by the cemetery. And what would make it right is really not anything to do with the land, but it's more a series of feasts could make it right. And also taking the children some things that they might need. Candy, food. So that's the conversation that's happening now. What needs to happen? So that as much as the children could rest in peace, that the elders could rest in peace. Elders can know that the right things have happened. And the community could come together and be part of this remembering. Okay. So two other projects have emerged all in the same time, all since November. There's lots of groups right now, including First Nations groups, that are giving considerable money to groups that want to create markers or artistic works at forgotten burial sites. So a group of us have applied for around $10,000 to have a commissioned piece of art put, you know, done at the cemetery. It's one of those things that takes a long time, and it's just kind of going through the bureaucratic channels. So, you know, it's just one of those things that we don't have to think about, but we applied for it so that it would be in the works. And that project, for that project, I worked with descendants of former students, many of whom live in Regina. And a really exciting project is the an independent film that's we've just locked in a core funding of $200,000 from the United Church, and it's a totally independent film. The United Church doesn't get to edit or say what happens in the film. It is simply that the story of the school be told. And two young First Nations filmmakers are the lead on that. Executive production or production comes from Birdsong, and they'll be going into First Nations communities that are interested, and using First Nations methodologies to gather stories and collect research. So very excited about that. Now that the research has begun on that this month, and so that's going very, very fast. Whereas our other work, contacting chiefs, that's much slower. But we do hope that the film will kind of light a fire under things. So, thanks. Next. And it's always a question about who has a stake in the future of the cemetery and who is responsible and who will care. I personally feel responsible just as a citizen to do what I can do. The former students are, descendants of former students are very interested when they hear about it, but there's a lot of just sitting back to see what will happen, and that's to be expected. First Nations elders are interested, but some of them are so triggered by this information that some of them have already pulled out of the project, and others are leading us. The owners are hard to get a hold of. They're in Brampton, as I say, and they've got a representative in Regina who we hope to reconnect with again soon. Okay. So that's where we're at. So I'd really love questions or clarifications.
Good. Thank you very much, Dawn. Does anyone have a question or a comment for this morning?
Dawn, I really appreciate what you're doing, and you're sharing this information with us. I have many questions. One of them started right when you began talking, and I was wondering about government intentions at the time with the industrial schools. Were they in any way more positive than later? And the children, were they treated better or the same, do you think? I mean, they're older than the small children that were scooped up. Anyway, do you know about that? And I was just thinking about the expense of it and then the money being clawed back, you know, over time.
I know.
I know that industrial education of all kinds at this time is practically non-existent because the same thing has happened. Yeah. It's very expensive, so people in charge of education aren't doing it.
Yeah.
Anyway, just historically, could you comment a little more about what went on at the schools?
Well, intentions, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Did they know what they were doing? What was their intention? From my friends and from all the reading I've been doing, it really seems that students had a better or a more devastating experience based on who was principal at the time. It seems to be right across the board. Did they have a principal who was basically a kind human being, or did they have a monster? And did he let the staff run wild? Like, who did he hire? So, not intending to gloss this school over at all, but there seem to be good principals here. The principals died. They themselves had the most shocking stories, but two died very suddenly, one after a week of hiccups. And one, you know, again, after another week of illness. And teachers died constantly, like the records just showing. There's very quick and lots of deaths of students, so it was that time. But the students visited the principal's families decades later in their homes. They stayed with them. There seemed to be great friendship. And I have no doubt that it was couched in the colonialism of the time. But it's such a guessing game. There's a really good thesis out about the industrial schools, and it's just rock solid intention was to Christianize and civilize, and part of that was there's so many things written in the Progress. I really encourage you, just go spend an afternoon and read through some issues of the Progress. You will probably go home and be sick to your stomach. The things they say. And I think that these children, even if they were teenagers, they were printing this material. They were handling this material. They saw what the teachers and the administrators were writing about their families. The things they said. On one hand, it's thick description. And so, like in one place, there's such a vivid description of an Indian burial of the time. It's exactly the way it happened and happens. So the descriptions are brilliant. They were really, really good, clear writers. But the sarcasm in the writing, the mockery, the put-downs, and that the students read that and wrote that, or just put that together in the paper. In one long, long article in the Progress, the principal and his cohort come back, and they were out to White Bear. They were down to White Bear, being led by one of the best guides of the time. They completely lost, and he actually admits that. He had no idea where he was going, couldn't get to White Bear, and the guide was leading them over hill and dale. And he says things like this slippery guide who did it for the money. So it's his job. They don't miss an opportunity to talk about how sneaky and how sharp and how sly and how in it for the money. And the way they talk about older First Nations women is a really clear portrayal of how strong the grandmothers were in the bands and in the clans. They talked about how the grandmothers will be the whole undoing of civilization. That they are shrill and they scream and they shriek in their loud voices when the children go off to the schools and they speak against the schools. They're backward, inferior, blah, 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 blah. They were in the biggest flap you can imagine about the way the women wore warm blankets when they came to visit their children. They got in such a flap over the craziest things. So read it because it's so transparent. I mean, the liberal way that we write today and the way everything is so couched and the racism is so hard to get at, whoa, it was all gloves off back then. Because it was just a different time. Like the colonial project was full out. So intention, I mean, they were